has emboldened successive Israeli regime cabinets to pursue a deliberate policy of expansion of illegal settlements with impunity. This is brazenly contrary to international law and has contributed to the further subjugation of Palestinians. The main manifestation of this creeping annexation is settlements. The word sounds benign, as if it is no more than experimental camping, but the truth is far worse. Settlements may start out as little more than the planting of a caravan, but over the decades, the process has become the full-scale annexation of their neighbor's land. Over half a million Israelis now live in modern-looking towns which are built on stolen land dotted all over the West Bank, thus making a would-be Palestinian state increasingly impractical. The phenomenon is far worse than the mere construction of houses in the wrong place. Settlers are often armed and violent. They displace Palestinians from their own homes, cut down the olive trees on which their livelihood depends, take their scarce water, and frequently subject them to abusive attacks. In turn, the Zionist regime forces known as IDF defend the illegal settlers instead of the indigenous Palestinians they attack. The settlements are served by bespoke roads and utilities, which are either denied to the Palestinians or do not serve their communities. Hand in hand with the settlement movement is the regular forced evictions and demolitions, which see so many Palestinians violently removed from their homes in their own country, all enforced and overseen by the apparatus of the Zionist regime. In Istanbul, according to the UN, one-third of all Palestinian homes are liable for demolition. This is why the forced evictions of Sheikh Jarrah is not a real estate issue, but part of a program of getting rid of Palestinians from large areas of East Al-Quds. The baseless claim that the fake regime of Israel is a respected democracy rings hollow when they behave in such an undemocratic way, whereas international law is clear that the West Bank is not theirs. Israelis justify their actions by claiming that the territory is disputed, as if to say that because they want it, their opinion is equal to that of the people whose land they wish to take. It is not. It is this same attitude that has created the serious unrest that has recently erupted. Al-Quds does not belong to the fake regime of Israel. The proposed enforced eviction of over 70 Palestinians from their homes in Sheikh Jarrah has ignited the flames of disorder. This has been simmering for weeks, during which extreme right-wing Israelis have been effectively supported by their police and troops in scenes that should bring the utmost shame to any Israeli. Blocking access to and throwing stun grenades into the Al-Aqsa Mosque is one thing. Beating people up and arresting children is quite another. Last autumn scenes of a soldier's knee on a Palestinian's neck should make everyone realize that Palestinian lives matter too. The campaign groups, NGOs, and websites are beginning to multiply in support of human rights, justice, and a fair future for Palestinians. The UK risks being seriously out of tune with the Israeli people. The last few weeks have starkly illustrated that the UK government has been living a lie for years. Its policies, such as it is, exist in a moral vacuum. While stating that the annexation of Palestinian land is in breach of international law and goes against countless UN resolutions, it only ever utters the language of de-escalation. While the scenes in Al-Quds have been clear for all to see, there hasn't been a single word of serious condemnation from the conservative friends of Israel, the labor friends of Israel, and the Board of Deputies or the government. All have found a way of not doing so. It seems the rules-based order only counts outside the occupied Palestine. The government has a hole in its policy. If it fails to stand for justice, the Conservative Party will forever have a hole in its heart.
Midstream.
The Yemeni resistance Ansarullah have refused to put down their weapons and enter any Saudi proposed talks before the full cessation of the Saudi war and the lift of all forms of blockade against the Yemeni nation. The Saudi plan supposedly includes a UN-supervised ceasefire, measures to reopen Sana'a airport in the Yemeni capital, and the lifting of trade restrictions on the Ansarullah-controlled Hudaydah port, but with a twist. The Saudis want to control the airport and the seaport themselves, while also sharing revenues on trade in oil through Hudaydah. Mohammed bin Salman wants to snatch through politics what he was not able to achieve through 6 years of extensive warfare against Yemen. For the Yemeni resistance, the devil is in the details. The Saudi aim is clear: control of vital Yemeni port of entries after they successfully suffocated the nation, leading it to become the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Whereas the Yemeni resistance wants Hudaydah port and Sana'a airport to be completely open to all international traffic, as they should. The Saudi overture appears to double down on the idea that it is the Yemeni resistance who is being asked to make concessions here, at a time when not only most Saudi-occupied cities have been liberated, but also scores of bomber drones on a weekly basis keep revisiting Saudi oil facilities and military bases in the heart of the kingdom. Ansarullah's response was very clear. This is an old offer, they said. Any new offer should begin with completely lifting barriers to movement on Hudaydah port and Sana'a airport. Using the humanitarian crisis as leverage is simply seen as a deceitful Saudi attempt, and Yemen will not fall for it. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. After 6 years of brutal Saudi war on Yemen, the Saudi ceasefire offer was taken by Yemen as nothing short of a joke. What is proposed to the Yemenis is not an end to the war. It is just a ceasefire while all other forms of war continue, such as blocking the airport, seaport, and the borders. What is proposed to Yemenis is a major deceit that neither Ansarullah or the Yemeni children would even accept to fall for. To discuss this issue with us from London is Patrick Henningsen, founder of the 21st Century Wire. Thank you a lot for being with us, Patrick. Now, Yemeni officials in Sana'a have recently emphasized that Yemen is only open to what they called a fair and honorable peace. That has nothing to do with the deceitful act of the ceasefire offer by Al Saud there, but while maintaining the blockade and maintaining the bombardment campaign against civilian areas in Yemen. Why is the world acting like Yemen has any other option than to actually wait for the war to stop and the blockade to be lifted?
I don't think Saudi Arabia or the world, the Western world for that matter, I don't think they're in a sort of space of reality, because these are all negotiation tactics that we have seen in the past. So, and the West, Saudi Arabia, these powers, they believe that they have leverage on the basis that they have military superiority and they have regional hegemony and they have control of the major waterways, ports, etc., the sky, the air, etc. So this is why they're negotiating as if the Yemeni Ansarullah's capitulation is a fait accompli, but that's not actually how it works when you're in a conflict. And right now, Saudi Arabia is still the aggressor. They can't change that fact. They're in a foreign country, so they don't have the leverage. And so they want to continue to strangle the Yemenis, to strangle Ansarullah in order to somehow get some concessions or some leverage on negotiation. And the Yemenis aren't going to agree to a ceasefire without getting exactly what they want, especially after everything that's happened.
This is why we should maybe look into this initiative. The Saudi initiative is said to include a nationwide ceasefire under the control or the supervision of the UN, supposedly, the reopening of Sana'a Airport and Hudaydah Port. But knowing that the power in those areas, Hudaydah Port, the airport, are in the hands of Ansarullah, could this actually be some sort of a new maneuver for Mohammed bin Salman to try and take control over them, since he already failed to do so militarily?
Possibly, but it could also be a sort of a long-term or medium to long-term strategy, because we've seen this in Syria. We've learned over the last few years that when an international ceasefire is declared, one party will use this as an opportunity to retrench or to sort of double down or to gain some ground that they had previously lost. Certainly this is something strategically that Saudi Arabia and its backers would like to do. And so for the Yemenis, they're totally in a defensive position, so there's no really change in their strategy. So the West, who's backing Saudi Arabia, and the Saudis and their allies are looking for some changes in order to change the strategic landscape. So we've also seen this in Libya. You have half the country, or Tripoli, under a UN administration, as it were. In Yugoslavia, we saw similar tactics with third parties coming in like the UN, and that can create other situations that's going to disrupt or allow one party not to be able to realize the gains that it would like on the battlefield, as it were.
But Patrick, with 5 million people currently teetering on the edge of starvation, and we have over two-thirds of the country's population in need for both food, medicine, and protection. Do you think that Yemen still has more time to waste for such a stalemate offer by Saudi Arabia? And what is the role of the international community in this one?
In terms of the famine, in terms of the human devastation, the humanitarian devastation, there's not a lot that can be done outside of Saudi Arabia withdrawing, its allies withdrawing, and basically leaving Yemen to govern itself, which was the previous status quo. Outside of that, it's going to be difficult. The end game has always been for Saudi Arabia and its allies has been partition or regime change, or both. And I really truly believe that they thought this was going to be over within 18 months of when it began in March of 2015, and that hasn't been the case. So if the Yemenis are still where they were before, they're still fighting to preserve their sovereignty, and that's not really going to change despite the devastation.
Well, the Rights and Legal Department at the Yemeni Ansarullah Political Bureau issued its first human rights document that was issued about a week ago about brutal crimes committed by the Saudi-U.S. aggression against Yemeni civilians. We have, it was, by the way, entitled Yemen's Hiroshima. The report included 4,133 documented massacres and bombing incidents in residential areas with details regarding the time and the place of their occurrences. Saudi Arabia has been stacking war crimes in Yemen for the past 6 years. Will Mohammed bin Salman and maybe his generals ever be brought to justice over these horrendous crimes? Do we have a chance against these people?
I think it's doubtful, and this is because international law is at an all-time low, and it's really receding year by year. The only persons that are going to get justice from the international law system or end up in The Hague will be some African dictator that was probably installed by a Western power to begin with. Those are the only people you ever see showing up in The Hague, more or less. But so the bottom line is that what Saudi Arabia has done is guaranteeing bad blood between the neighbors on the Arabian Peninsula. And so you can't erase that. This is going to sow the seeds for potentially future conflicts. There needs to be a unilateral withdrawal on the side of Saudi Arabia and a cessation of hostilities. This is the only way that we're going to avert more humanitarian disaster. Everything besides that is just really going to be a protracted, painful conflict, unfortunately. And well, we'll see if the West is going to come in like a knight on a white horse to try to, you know, broker some sort of negotiations, but or some roadmap to peace. But at the end, I think it's too late for that.
Well, it seems that Biden is a bit in hot water whether to back Mohammed bin Salman or not. Sometimes he gives him a good word, sometimes three bad words in a row. But at the same time, Yemeni civilians are losing their lives. They're losing their lives from bombs falling on their heads, Western-made bombs. They're losing their lives from the famine created by Saudi Arabia with the help of the West. And at the same time, if the West thinks really that they're going to try and do anything to stop this without the consent of the Yemeni people, those same Yemenis that are still in control of swaths of land of their country that have been able to liberate the occupied parts of their country, then they are really in on a wrong side here. They don't really understand Yemenis yet. I want to thank you very much, Patrick Henningsen, founder of the 21st Century Wire, for being with us. Now, please stay tuned. We will be next talking about the Lebanese crisis of economy. Stay with us.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts.
For the past 19 months, Lebanon has been reeling from a wrenching economic crisis. By the time the crisis erupted in October in 2019, the economy was facing four extraordinary challenges: elevated public sector debt, a bankrupt banking sector, no economic growth, and the country was politically rudderless. Predicting how the crisis evolves from here is difficult. Lebanon's economic crisis, a tragedy in the making, in this following report. Lebanon's annual inflation rate reached a record high, and food prices soared by around 500% in February, highlighting the dramatic impact on consumers and businesses of the country's worst financial crisis in decades. With hindsight, Lebanon's economic crisis was predictable. By the time the crisis erupted in October 2019, the economy was already facing four extraordinary challenges. First, public sector debt had reached such elevated levels that a default had become a question of when, not if. Second, the banking sector, having lent three-quarters of deposits to the government, had become functionally bankrupt and increasingly illiquid. Third, the productive economy had experienced virtually no growth for an entire decade, a development with acute socio-political implications. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, the country was politically aimless. There was no president between 2014 and 2016. There were multiple and lengthy delays in cabinet formation, and the 2018 parliamentary elections took place, but only after a five-year delay. The Hariri government that was in place when the crisis hit in 2019 became impotent to such an extent that it lacked power to deliver on any of the reforms required as a condition for foreign support. By October 2019, the citizenry had had enough. Sensing a looming crisis and frustrated by the utter lack of action by the political class, hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets demanding radical political change. The cabinet resigned, throwing the country into a political crisis.
Unsurprisingly, capital inflows came to a sudden halt. Banks, already insolvent, experienced a sharp liquidity crunch, forcing them to declare a bank holiday and institute severe restrictions on bank withdrawals. A foreign exchange black market emerged, and the national currency, the lira, sharply depreciated. In return, inflation soared and people's real wages and purchasing power collapsed. In addition, as if all these woes aren't enough, a severe COVID-19 crisis hit the country, and most tragically, a devastating explosion took place on August 4, 2020, leveling a third of downtown Beirut. Human capital is fast eroding due to a massive brain drain of the young and skilled. Equally worrying is the loss of physical productive capacity resulting from widespread business closures. Much more alarming are the security consequences of the economic implosion. Lebanon's sectarian history is rife with conflict, and economic collapse provides a perfect habitat for a return of violence.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Nasri Harb, economist and dean of the Faculty of Management, Finance and Economics at Yuzal University. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Nasri Harb. Now, left to its own devices, the Lebanese economy will for sure generate an alarming acceleration of youth and skilled labor immigration. We have a lot of enterprises closing. The currency is becoming further unanchored. Hyperinflation is wiping the incomes of the public and their wealth. And we have now food and medical shortages that seem will only escalate, which requires more level of humanitarian support, foreign humanitarian support. That is the worst case scenario, and I thought that we were already there. Could this become even worse now?
Okay. Hi, Marwa. I think there is no limit to how bad we can go. Let me tell you this. As long as the government does not take any action, things will worsen. The hyperinflation will fuel itself. As a number, we can cite two recent examples from two economies. In Venezuela, for instance, where inflation has reached about 65,000%.
Wow.
That is a 71% inflation every month, which means that your salary that you receive at the beginning of the month will lose 70% of its value at the end of the month. So you are left with only 30%. Another typical example is, a famous example is Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe, in the peak of the hyperinflation, currency used to lose a 98%, which is almost its whole value every day at the peak of the inflation. So there is no limit to how bad we can go.
That is a scary thought right there.
Indeed.
But there is one best case scenario for Lebanon that's being discussed all around now, is by starting with a cabinet. That should be giving some sort of a short-term stabilization program for the country, which involves tightening of liquidity, maybe arresting the fiscal implosion, maybe using capital control, especially on large amounts of money which are still being leaked out of the country, and maybe obtaining an urgent external bridge loan like that of the IMF. However, look, I understand all these points that we are speaking about, but wouldn't even more loans by the Lebanese be a burden for them rather than an actual escape from this reality?
The loan from the IMF, you can say it's a double-edged sword.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, from one side, it will call for more reform. It will help. And it will ask for discipline from the government. However, on the other hand, if there is no discipline, if the loan is not well negotiated, because the trend at the IMF is to follow more liberal action, reducing government size, and taking harsh action towards the harsh social action. So if it's not well negotiated, it may lead to further social problems.
You mean more privatization instead of actually putting help towards the public institutions?
Exactly. So it takes strong political action and strong political negotiate a good terms for these loans. That's one. Two, if this loan is not well used, it will add to the burden of the country, like the debt to the country, like similar to what happened to Paris conferences. We have received aids and billions of dollars, and after all, it came out like as a burden on the country.
And our debt becomes $120 billion.
Exactly.
But the annual inflation rate, Dr. Harb, is that it reached a high record and the food prices soared. They are more than 500% this February 2021, highlighting the dramatic impact on both consumers and enterprises as well, especially because this is the worst economic crisis for at least two decades. How much longer do you think these businesses can withstand such a dramatic impact on them?
It's difficult to say, but however, the conditions are very harsh. If we can cite what are the problems faced by the businesses, it's unbelievable. You have one, reduced demand. People are poorer than before. Difficult investment because there is no exchange. Unstable exchange rate. You can start with a given price, and then at the end of the day, the price will be changed. Uncertainty, okay? You can never tell what to expect in the next day. Unmotivated employees, which will reduce the cost of production. Mm-hmm. You have also angry consumer, which will be very difficult to deal with. You have difficult financial transaction. If you want to export, if you want to import, how can I afford the exchange rate? Okay? The cost of changing price is by itself. Cost of changing price is huge. Mm-hmm. In some cases, in some supermarket, like during, I think, German hyperinflation, 50% of the employees' time was on only changing prices.
So it's very costly for the
exactly.
enterprise.
So just changing prices takes like 50% of your resources. So
and the remaining 50% is now becoming a referee trying to stop people from killing one another. But
sure.
what are you saying represents a public call, Dr. Nasri, to all Lebanese decision makers, whether it is the prime minister designated one, the central bank governor, even the president of the republic as well. I personally do not see a glimmer of hope here. I'm a realist. But as an economist, what would be the first thing that you would do to try and salvage what is left of the economy in this country?
Okay. Well, we were speaking about that in a conference a few days ago. Mm-hmm. What it takes at the beginning, first of all, like a political will. Okay. Once we have a political will, any action can help. It takes a multilateral plan. You have, first of all, of course, you have to have a sort of capital control. You have to and that's very important, to establish trust. So I would say trust, then trust, then trust. That's the first point. Capital control, restoration of banking sector, okay? And we can speak also about halting the money printing process, because this is the main cause of the inflation. Economical reforms and structural reforms. I can speak here about political reform and economical reform. Especially, like we can give an example, a simple example, which will be a good start, is to rebuild the electrical system for electrical sector. Rebuild it, okay. And an important one is to encourage import substituting industries, mm-hmm. because this is one of the main source of fleeing the currency.
See, this is what we lack in Lebanon, Dr. Nasri. We should have someone like you to be Minister of Economy, and yet we are still fighting between one another which sect will get which ministry, which, by the way, puts me at a very depressed position as a Lebanese citizen, because I don't know whether tomorrow will be better or even 10 times worse. Mm-hmm. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Nasri Harab, economist and dean of the Faculty of Management, Finance and Economics at Izal University. Thank you very much for being with us, and thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East stream.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Over 100 U.S.-based advocacy groups issued a statement urging the Biden administration to condemn the Israeli regime's plan to ethnically cleanse thousands of Palestinians from neighborhoods in East Al-Quds. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Brett Wilkins Ryder. This article is titled, More Than 100 Groups Condemn Israeli Regime Violence in East Al-Quds and Gaza. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The death toll from the Zionist regime's ongoing air and artillery strikes in Gaza reaches dozens, and as the regime's security forces killed dozens of protesters in the occupied West Bank, over 100 U.S.-based advocacy groups issued a statement urging the Biden administration to condemn the Israeli regime's plan to ethnically cleanse thousands of Palestinians from neighborhoods in East Al-Quds. The groups, which include Peace, Faith-Based, Labor, Racial Justice, and other organizations, wrote that they stand in solidarity with the Palestinian residents of occupied East Al-Quds, currently at risk of losing their homes, and call on the Biden administration to immediately and publicly condemn the Zionist regime's plans to forcibly displace 1,550 Palestinians from their homes in the Sheikh Jarrah and Al-Busta neighborhoods, while urging the U.S. administration to exert the utmost diplomatic pressure to prevent these potential war crimes from taking place. The statement says the planned expulsions are occurring in the broader context of Israel's ongoing policy to forcibly remove Palestinians from their homes through eviction, home demolition, and displacement, with the express intent of pushing Palestinians out of Al-Quds in order to create and maintain a Jewish majority and supremacy in the city. decrying the overwhelming violence and force from Israeli regime police and settlers against Palestinians at Al-Aqsa Mosque during the holy month of Ramadan. The statement notes specific disturbing incidents that have occurred in Isr al-Quds, including a police officer kneeling on a protester's neck while he shouts he is being suffocated, and Jerusalem Deputy Mayor Aryeh King telling a Palestinian activist it was a pity that he wasn't shot in the head. The statement continues, Israeli state violence is of course not limited to Jerusalem. We are horrified by Israel's use of disproportionate and deadly force against Palestinians in Gaza, which have already resulted in the killings of dozens of Palestinians, including children. This comes within the context of Israel's 14-year illegal blockade on Gaza, which has created an open-air prison with severe shortages of life-saving medicines, food, electricity, and clean water, making life unsafe and unbearable. We call on the Biden administration to condemn this violence and address its root causes, Israeli blockade and occupations. The signatories said that the Biden administration must uphold international law and act in accordance with the urgency of the moment to prevent the Israeli regime's forced displacement of thousands of Palestinians. Finally, they affirmed their support for a letter led by U.S. representatives Mary Newman and Mark Pocan and signed by 23 other House Democrats, urging the Biden administration to pressure Israeli regime leaders to desist from its plans to demolish Palestinian homes in Al-Bustan and evict Palestinians from their homes in Sheikh Jarrah. Group's statement comes a day after progressive members of the U.S. House of Representatives convened a special hour also organized by Newman and Pocan, during which the lawmakers discussed the root causes of Israeli violence, namely the foundation of Israel through settler colonization, ethnic cleansing, and ongoing oppression and apartheid. If we are to make good on our promises to support equal human rights for all, it is our duty to end the apartheid system that for decades has subjected Palestinians to inhumane treatment and racism, reducing Palestinians to live in utter fear and terror of losing a child, being indefinitely detained or killed because of who they are, and the unequal rights and protections they have under Israeli law, said Representative Rashida Tlaib, a Michigan Democrat and the first Palestinian-American woman elected to Congress. She added, "It must end."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Islamic.
This is a part of a speech delivered on May 7, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution on the occasion of the International Al-Quds Day. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, in his speech on the occasion of International Quds Day, referring to the change in the balance of power in favor of Islamic world and Palestine, emphasized, "I tell you with confidence the downward movement of the Zionist regime has started and will not stop."
Another noteworthy point is that although that the usurping regime was established in 1948, the ground for occupying that sensitive Islamic region had been prepared years before that. Those specific years coincided with the active interference of Westerners in Islamic countries with the purpose of establishing secularism, an excessive and blind nationalism, and also with the goal of installing despotic governments who were infatuated with or controlled by the West. Studying those events in Iran, Turkey, and Arab countries, stretching from West Asia to North Africa, reveals this bitter truth that weakness and discord in the Islamic Ummah paved the way for the disastrous usurpation of Palestine, allowing the world of arrogance to deliver that blow to the Islamic Ummah.
Every day we tell each other that this day will be the last, and tomorrow we all can go home free, and all this will finally end. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine,
it is instructive that at that time, the capitalism and communism camps colluded with the rich Zionists. It was the English who masterminded the plot and who persisted in it, and then Zionist capitalists executed it with their money and weapons. The Soviet Union, too, was one of the first governments that officially recognized the establishment of that illegitimate regime, and later on, dispatched a large number of Jews to that area. The usurping regime was actually an outcome of that situation in the world of Islam, on the one hand, and of a European plot, invasion, and transgression on the other. Today, the situation in the world is not like those days. We should keep this reality within sight. Today, the balance of power has swung in favor of the world of Islam. Various political and social incidents in Europe and in the United States have laid bare the weaknesses and the deep structural, managerial, and moral conflicts among Westerners.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
Among the most critical goals that the Palestinians have achieved in the Gaza Strip was to demonstrate the failure of the Iron Dome to intercept all incoming domestically manufactured rockets targeting Israeli-occupied areas. Gaza flooded the Israeli sophisticated interception systems when launching over 100 rockets simultaneously. We're prepared for an article written by Elijah J. Magnier, a veteran war correspondent and a senior political risk analyst with decades of experience covering the West Asia region. The piece is titled Gaza Hits Israel's Prestige Despite Tel Aviv's Claim to Being Superpower. With its different Palestinian factions, Gaza collectively consecrated the state of Palestinian consciousness of all Palestine and achieved its goal of breaking the prestige of Israel, despite Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's claim that it had become a superpower, not just a regional power. This new Palestinian awareness was achieved following the Israeli escalation and aggressive campaign against the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, inhabited by more than 38 Palestinian families threatened with eviction from their homes. The Israeli regime also savagely attacked the Al-Aqsa Mosque demonstrators. The destiny of the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood has become an international issue that raises global awareness and solidarity with the oppressed Palestinians. The Palestinian cause had been absent from the international arena following a number of Arab regimes' normalization of ties with the Israeli regime, and when former U.S. President Donald Trump offered all of Al-Quds to the Israeli regime. However, the battle in Gaza is not expected to stop soon because Israel is trying to restore its so-called deterrent power it has lost due to the Palestinian missiles successfully fired from the Gaza Strip. Moreover, what is unusual is the uprising of the 1948 Arabs. After 72 years of occupation, in the city of Lida in particular, and in other Israeli-occupied cities, they have proven that the new generation wants to regain their occupied territory, rejecting the unsuccessful Oslo and Camp David agreements. It is highly plausible that the Israeli regime has also acted in its own interest by disrupting the Palestinian presidential elections that coincided with the illegal eviction of the Sheikh Jarrah families to prevent the Palestinians in the city of Al-Quds from participating in the polls. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is undoubtedly aware that attacking the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the inhabitants of the city of Al-Quds is like lighting the fuse of a powder keg. The first and the second intifada were the best proof of these explosive possibilities. Palestinian resistance groups Hamas and Islamic Jihad and all other factions in the Gaza Strip have succeeded in achieving unity with Al-Quds by defending it. Hamas did not start bombing Israeli settlements before giving Israel many hours to stop attacking the civilian population in the city of Al-Quds. However, Tel Aviv insisted on its position and dragged everyone into the battle so that Benjamin Netanyahu would achieve his goal to postpone the Israeli elections to save his political future. The Palestinian groups in Gaza attacked Tel Aviv, Ashkelon, Ashdod with hundreds of rockets that reached not far from Haifa. The Israeli officials failed to anticipate the intensity of the Palestinian rocket response and the reaction to its abuse of power and bombing of the Gaza Strip. The various resistance groups proved their credibility with timing and intimidation. They gained more significant popularity among the Palestinians and the Arab populations supporting the cause and against the normalization of ties with the Israeli regime. Among the most critical goals that the Palestinians have achieved in the Gaza Strip was to demonstrate the failure of Israel's so-called Iron Dome system to intercept all incoming domestically manufactured rockets targeting Israeli-occupied areas. Gaza flooded the Israeli sophisticated interception systems when launching over 100 rockets simultaneously. Israel admitted it could not stop the firing of rockets, even though the Israeli army bombed dozens of targets. To harm the population, the Zionist regime bombed several civilian towers, the Al-Hanadi Tower, the Al-Johara, and the Al-Shuruq Tower in Gaza, in prestigious commercial and residential areas, with the intention to turn the inhabitants against the Palestinian groups confronting Israel. So far, the Palestinian Ministry of Health has announced that recent Israeli strikes have taken the martyrdom toll in the Gaza Strip to 188, including 55 children and 33 women, with 1,230 Palestinians injured. The Palestinian groups were able to launch more than 1,300 rockets. Embarrassing scenes appeared of members of the Israeli Knesset and the Ministry of Defense fleeing to bomb shelters. Not only has Israel lost its ability to deter, but it has also lost its prestige. The story of Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, in the aftermath of the 1948 expulsion of Palestinians, known as the Nakba, around 750,000 Palestinians were forced to flee their homes to neighboring countries. Following these events, 28 families, today there are 38 families, settled in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in East Al-Quds in 1956. They reached an agreement with the Jordanian Ministry of Construction and Development and the United Nations Refugee Agency, UNRWA, to provide housing for them in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. At that time, the occupied West Bank was under Jordanian rule from 1951 to 1967. The Jordanian government provided the land, while UNRWA covered the cost of constructing 28 homes for these Palestinian families. It was agreed that the residents pay a symbolic fee, provided that the ownership was transferred to the residents more than 3 years from the completion of the construction. This, however, was interrupted by the Israeli occupation of the West Bank, including the city of Al-Quds in 1967, which prevented the registration of the houses under the names of the Palestinian families. This month, Jordan's foreign ministry said it had provided the Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs with 14 ratified agreements meant for the people of the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in eastern Al-Quds, which support their claim of their lands and property. In a statement, Jordan's foreign ministry said it handed over a certificate to the residents proving that the Jordanian Ministry of Construction and Development had agreed with UNRWA to establish 28 housing units in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood to be delegated and registered in the name of these Palestinian families. However, the process was interrupted as a result of the Israeli occupation of the West Bank in 1967. The Jordanian Foreign Ministry had previously provided the Palestinian side with all the documents that could help these residents of Al-Quds maintain their full rights, including lease contracts, lists of beneficiaries' names, and a copy of the agreement concluded with UNRWA back in 1954. In 1972, the Sephardic Committee and the Knesset Committee of Israel claimed that they owned the land on which the houses were built in 1885 and asked the court to evict four Palestinian families from their homes in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, accusing them of land grab. In 1982, the Israeli settlement Associations filed an eviction case against 24 Palestinian families in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, and 17 families assigned Israeli lawyer Tosia Cohen to defend them. The lawyer in 1991 signed an agreement without the knowledge of the families that the ownership of the land belonged to the settlement associations. The lawyer put Palestinian families under the threat of eviction if they failed to pay the rent to the settlement associations. In 1997, Suleiman Darwish Hijazi, a resident, filed a lawsuit with the Israeli Central Court to prove his land ownership, using title deeds issued by the Ottoman Empire, brought from Turkey. However, the move backfired when the Israeli court rejected the claim in 2005. The court said the papers did not prove his land ownership, and Hijazi's appeal in the following year was rejected. In November 2008, the Al-Kurd family was evicted from their home, followed by eviction of the Hanoun and Al-Qawi families in August of 2009. So far, 12 Palestinian families in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood have received eviction orders issued by the Israeli Central and Magistrate Courts. 4 Palestinian families filed a petition with the Israeli Supreme Court, Israel's highest judicial body, against the decision to expel them from their homes. The Israeli Central Court in Eastern Al-Quds approved the decision earlier this year to evict 4 Palestinian families from their homes in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in favor of right-wing, illegal Israeli settlers. In 1948, Al-Sabaq's family forcibly expelled from their home in Yaffa, which Israelis now inhabit. The Al-Sabaq family, a 32-member family, including 10 children, is afraid that the court verdict will make them and their family refugees again.
Around the World with Reporters.
It is the beginning of a series of public protests in Pakistan over no let-up to the atrocities against Palestinians by Israel in the occupied land. Like elsewhere in the Muslim world, people are raging with anger in Pakistan since last week when Israel attacked Al-Aqsa Mosque in the occupied Al-Quds Sharif and later waged a unilateral war against unarmed Palestinians in Gaza. The Al-Aqsa is the third holiest Islamic site, the desecration of which by Israel has led to the beginning of a renewed wave of public anger against Israel in this part of the world. More protests have been planned to build a public pressure on government to stop ongoing attacks on unarmed Palestinians. Before protests like this one spread across the country, Pakistan has raised the issue in a virtual emergency meeting of Executive Committee of Organization of Islamic Cooperation, or the OIC, a 50-member bloc of Muslim countries.
There are no words strong enough to condemn the systematic and barbaric crimes against the Palestinians. The deteriorating conditions in the occupied Palestinian territories due to the illegal practices of Israel, the colonial policies and its continued aggression, siege and collective punishment are sickening.
However, people attach little hope with the OIC, given its track record of doing little beyond issuing anti-Israel statements. People are particularly angry against the Muslim rulers, including their own, for restricting their official reaction so far to mere customary statements of condemnation, which they say is no longer acceptable to them. They want particularly Pakistan, Turkey and Iran to undertake concrete measures to prevent of what they call Israeli aggression at a time when many Arab countries have been allegedly siding with the apartheid state.
Hazur Pak sallallahu alaihi wasallam ka irshad hai.
Our Prophet peace be upon him said that Muslim nation is just like the one body. If one part of it gets injured, the other part would feel its pain. Israel is committing atrocities on our children, brothers and sisters. It is obvious that we feel its pain. Our hearts beat with our Palestinian brothers. Pakistan